welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, and I am joined, as I always am, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein. He's the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU, and a senior lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, California burning. And Richard, when it comes to politics and public policy, national news is usually federal news. It tends to focus on things that are happening in Washington. But every once in a while, you get a story from the state or local level that really seems to touch a chord and go national. And one of those lately has been the situation in California, where after a wave of really severe wildfires stretching back a few years, you've had a lot of major disruptions, not the least of which is these rolling blackouts, because Pacific Gas and Electric, the utility that supplies power for Northern California, is already up against bankruptcy for its role in starting some of these earlier fires and is looking to avoid its exposure to any further liabilities. So it has simply shut down power episodically rather than run the risk of igniting another blaze. Now, there's a new wrinkle in the story, which we'll get to in a moment, but let's begin with a sense of what's actually been going on here. A lot of observers have pointed to what's happened in California and said, you know what? It's inevitable. These are the wages of climate change. Do you buy that explanation?
That explanation is, I think, in this particular case, preposterous. Let me start to explain that climate change has two dimensions associated with its operation. One is the long term, and the other is the short term. In the last 2 years, I think it is commonly recognized that the level of global temperatures went down by 1 degree Fahrenheit, much to the mystification of anybody else, so that the world was a cooler place in 2018 than it was in 2016. And this was in part because the really high La Nina years in 2016 created this temperature thing, and then there was a drop. We had a similar peak back in 1998, followed by another drop. In the short run, what they're telling you is that the increase in climate change took place when temperatures were dropping. It also is the case that the level of severity in these years globally, it varies enormously. I think in 2017, total global losses were about twice or more than they were in 2018. So you can't predict anything short term about variations that you see in relationship to climate change. The argument about climate change essentially is, if you look over the long run between the curve on carbon dioxide concentrations and temperatures, you'll see what many people claim to be an eerie similarity. You can dispute that at some level. It's also disputed as to exactly how great that temperature change is. Roughly speaking, from about 1950 to the year 2020 is coming up, it's a change somewhat under 1 degree Fahrenheit, or centigrade rather. So it's not been an enormous amount of shifts that we've seen going on in the short run. The question is whether or not there's some pent-up danger. But if you're trying to explain a short-term fire by temperature claim, you cannot do it. What you need to do is to therefore look to the obvious explanations. And what are those? Well, the first thing is, if you actually were to go in the air and look at land, what you would discover is there's a complete difference between land which is owned by private companies like Georgia Pacific, which is a Koch subsidiary, and government-owned and operated land. Georgia Pacific actually knows how to manage land. The government has all sorts of contradictory orders and cases. And what it does is it basically creates the perfect fire trap. They don't clear out dead wood. They don't clear out all these little twigs that grow up. They don't thin the forest. So what you do is you have this matted mass of stuff. And the smallest breeze can give you a huge conflagration. Because what happens is first the little twigs burn the dead wood, then the heat gets large enough and they start to burn the trees. Then it gets up to the high areas and the wind starts to carry it along. And so you can see this pathology. Every one of these fires has begun on public lands. None of them have begun on private lands. And if this is a function of global change, why is it that global stuff seems to leave the, it's like the good Passover witches and so forth, leave the land of the private companies untouched and wrecks the public lands? What has happened is the combination of mandates that the legislature has imposed on Pacific Gas and Electric and the way in which the company chooses to run itself has resulted in an incredible amount of waste and confusion. The legislature is very much, shall we say, into diversity and inclusion, what kinds of things you do. It's also very much into solar power and to alternative forms of energy. And what happens is the diversity effort on the one hand and the alternative energy effort on the other hand create a set of mandates so that people tend to invest in taking care of existing power structures and power lines. So you don't clean them at the frequency that you should. You don't thin things out. And, you know, is the blame to the legislature or to PG&E? Legally, just to give the one sentence answer to this question, the government is largely insulated by the so-called discretionary function exception to the Federal Tort Claims Act and also to the California statute, whereas a public utility doesn't get that kind of protection. So all the suits are going to be brought against the utility. And one of the reasons why the government doesn't want to take this over is there's always the risk that politically, at the very least, they may be required to take on these inherited liabilities. But instead of worrying about global warming, what you have to do is to worry about management at every stage. And the global warming is a real tragedy in this case as an explanation, because it diverts the attention from fixing things that are fixable into talking about things that are not fixable and allowing you to externalize the blame away from the people who are responsible for it in both government and the private sector.
Okay, let's talk about the newest development here, which actually precipitated your most recent column for Defining Ideas. Ricardo Lara, who is the insurance commissioner for the state of California, that is an elected position charged with regulating the insurance industry. He has imposed a one-year moratorium on insurers to drop coverage for homeowners in areas that are at risk for these fires. By the way, if our listeners are wondering how a state insurance commissioner gets the ability to act unilaterally like this, it's actually because of a piece of legislation that Lara himself wrote when he was in the legislature. Now, he says that this moratorium is a chance to let the market stabilize, give some breathing room to homeowners. You are, based on the column, to say the least, skeptical of this idea. Explain where you think it goes wrong.
Well, what happens is 1 year is an eternity in this business, and in the interim, other things are going to start to decay. First of all, if you give the moratorium, it's going to reduce some of the pressure politically to fix the underlying situation. Secondly, when you impose a moratorium like this, you at least in the short run protect many of the people with coverage, but there's a serious risk that there's going to be some bankruptcy because the rates in question are going to be too low if there should, God forbid, be another disaster. In addition, nobody who needs a first-time insurance will be able to get it because this only covers renewals. And in addition, all the commercial establishments are going to have to bear very, very high rates because, as is often the case under these circumstances, PG&E will find, or rather the insurers who are doing the private stuff, will try to raise their commercial rates to offset their losses in the other market. And so everything is going to essentially get worse. And then when the end of the year comes and there's no fix on the basic situation, he's going to say, well, we have to extend it a second time. And that then increases the risk of bankruptcy and also leaves the rest of the market underserved. What you have to do under these circumstances is if you really think that you want homeowners to get some kind of a subsidy, you don't take it out of state insurers with local businesses and force them to raise rates to cover these losses in Georgia and in Mississippi and in Minnesota. What you do is you go to the state legislature and say, we wish to have some kind of a premium supplementation program coming out of general revenues to help the homeowners. They're never going to do anything like that because if there's anything which is unpopular in California, already an overstated, overtaxed state, it's exactly this kind of maneuver. So what this is it's an effort in the federalism system to try to export the cost of the rather profound negligence of all the California actors onto people in other states where things have been better managed. So the federal issues are there. I think the confiscation issues are there. I think the further disintegration of what's going to happen, both to the regulated and unregulated parts of the market are there. And I don't think Mr. Lara has thought any of this through.
We should probably note as well that Lara's policy has the force of law as it applies to these communities that are vulnerable to fires, but he actually also was calling on insurers to voluntarily apply this statewide. So let's talk about the part that actually has the force You make an argument in your defining ideas piece. There's actually some legal precedent suggesting this policy might not stand up in court, that there are legal limits to how much you can restrain the discretion of insurers. Explain that for us.
Well, what happens is insurance is now an industry which is said to be affected with the public interest, and so therefore subject to some degree of direct regulation. But like other industries that are affected with the public interest and subject to direct regulation, there's a kind of an offsetting principle, which is if the regulation is confiscatory, then it turns out it's going to be unconstitutional, and they will order a removal of the rate restrictions. So you could basically, in this case, go back to free market cases, or when you're dealing with other kinds of utilities that may raise the permissible rates. Now, there are two kinds of industries that are subject to these situations. One of them are public utilities who are common carriers, and there the rate regulation is essentially designed to be a counterweight to the monopoly power that these kinds of firms have. That is their ability to raise the rates above a competitive level because they have no competition and still keep their customers. But when you try to control against that, there's the danger that they will set the rates so low and that the companies will not be able to recover the fixed cost investments that they have to make before they get a dime out of anything. And so what the rate regulation with common carriers is designed to do is to give confidence to public utilities that they could sink their money in today so they could get revenues tomorrow. The insurance industry is exactly the opposite. It is not a monopolistic industry. They'll insure as large to insure. It's highly competitive. But insurance is exactly the mirror image of a public utility. That's an industry in which everybody gets their money first at the companies by taking premiums, and then they have to pay it out later. And so what rate regulation tends to do with respect to the insurance industry is to make sure that the premiums that are paid today will be available to answer the claims that will be raised against the company tomorrow. And so there were going to be various kinds of restrictions on dividends that these countries can pay, the kinds of investments that they have to make, and so forth, so as to make sure that the solvency is available. What he's doing in this case, Laura, is trying to put rate regulation on an industry which really doesn't need it. And so the question is, when he does this and he forces them to operate their businesses at a loss, can you make the claim that this is heavily confiscatory? And the argument has sometimes been made, well, you could cover these costs by raising your rates in other businesses, but there are early precedents going back to the early 1920s in which they say, no, every particular line of insurance has to raise its own money, and you can't tell people that they have to lose money in business A because they could always raise it in rate B because they could separate the two companies and the second one could raise its rates. And in any event, the cross subsidies create all sorts of market distortions, so that turns out to be illegal. Now, in California, there was a case called Cow Farm decided about 30 years ago, in which they did was to impose a genuine 20% rollback, I think it was, on automobile insurance rates on the grounds that these had become too high and oppressive and were driving people out of the market. And what happened is the California Supreme Court actually struck this thing down as confiscatory. And it gave all sorts of reasons as to why this was the case, because they said, you certainly don't want to have a situation where you're going to drive companies bankrupt. And you certainly don't want to have a situation where if, in fact, you're a company which has borrowed money and have to make payments to your creditors, that they're going to have to give you higher rates because otherwise you'll be foreclosed. Whereas if you have an all-equity business with no debt, then you could just lose your own money and you could stay in business. He said, all this is crazy. We don't want rate regulation to decide whether or not you want to have a capital structure with or without debt. And they struck it down. Now, we don't know what the exact increase is in this case, but it could easily be the situation that market rates would be 20 or even more over what the current rates are. Mr. Lara, as a bad insurer, says that, well, we just use historical information, to which the answer is, when you have better information than historical rates, mainly the risk of major fires, which is going to continue unabated, then you have to update your priors, and he's not willing to do that. So I actually think the insurance companies have a very strong case to saying that, you know, you may have a lot of troubles, but you cannot export the troubles that you have because of the way in which you've run your business on us and through us on everybody else. So One of the reasons why this is so deadly is if you take a carrier that does business in other states and they're now forced to pay out claims in California from their capital, that reduces the amount of free capital they have, which is needed to support the ability to underwrite claims in other states or to issue new policies. And since they can't do it, they're going to have to raise the rates everywhere else, or they're going to have to borrow more equity capital of one kind or another in order to be or to raise more equity capital in order to stay inside this business. Well, this is a massive distortion. And I think, in fact, that the insurance industry would be quite within its rights to say that you can't do it. They'd have to find the proper plaintiffs. That should not be too difficult. Just take anybody who's hit with a rate. You'd probably take somebody who says, you increase this rate, I'm going out of business, as many insurers already have. And I think the issue could be squarely joined. And my guess is that you could get an expedited hearing on this stuff. I think the insurance companies are more than likely to win this particular case, at which point California is then going to have to get rid of this particular situation, allow for market rates, and that will actually give them incentive to clean up this particular mess by changing their environmental priorities and changing their general priorities on diversity and inclusion in favor of greater safety and health for its various citizens. This is a very tragic situation. And in terms of environmental issues, you really want to talk about pollution? These fires are much more deadly and much more toxic than all the automobiles driven inside the state during the same period. So the state is its own greatest environmental menace.
I want to close just in brief with a kind of a tantalizing observation that you drop in the piece. In one passage, you say that climate change has, and I'm quoting you here, become a convenient scapegoat for the systematic failure of federal and state governments to adopt proven fire prevention strategies, the list of which you provide as power line maintenance, which we've talked about, tree clearance, which we've talked about, and the curbing of new housing developments in fire-prone districts, close quote. That last one might surprise some people, especially since so many places in California are fire-prone districts, to hear a libertarian say you just shouldn't be able to build there. Would you entertain a government ban here, or do you have something else in mind?
Well, the easy and the hard version of it. First of all, whenever you're dealing with this, you never allow people to build in these particular areas and to get insurance at subsidized rates. So this is, again, the same kind of play that happens when people build along the coast and various kinds of hurricanes wipe them out. On the other issue, it's actually very difficult because fire has always been the source of extensive regulation, even amongst libertarians, because the fires that started in one location have external threats with respect to everybody else. So if you allow somebody to build a house in a major fire zone and it catches fire and that fire then stretches somewhere else, it's going to be awfully difficult to have a remedy after the fact to say, it was your house that burned when it was nearby, and so therefore you have to pay me. That's never going to happen. And so what you have to do is to switch to the other side and enjoin the thing from happening. If you do it on vacant land, it's going to reduce to some extent the value of the plots of the land, but not by very much, particularly if when you put the prohibition in there, you also take away the insurance subsidies. And so what then happens is you get more rational land use. And I don't think there's any court in the country in 1900 which would have said that this stuff did not go. Many, many years ago, I wrote a piece about Scandinavian realism and fire protection. I had been on a trip to Norway, and we'd gone to several villages which had burnt down periodically every several hundreds of years. And the question is, how did they organize themselves? Well, the first thing they did was very unlibertarian. They prohibited anybody from having a fire or a kitchen in their own home. And it turns out all the businesses that required the use of flames was segregated by a zoning system to a remote part of the area, which was always to be downwind from everything else, so that if it did catch fire, the fire would go away from the situations. And they essentially then organized all of their activities to make sure that this fire would be controlled. It's a kind of a zoning system and prohibition system and so forth. And, you know, they knew why they did it. We had the Chicago fire of 1871, and then there was the London fire in 1669. After those fires, everybody changed the kinds of materials that you could build. Very non-libertarian, I don't think so. But you said you can't build with, you know, inflammable woods. You've got to start having stone. So in Chicago, I live right across from the water tower, which is built out of stone and is capable of resisting these kinds of fires. So I think, in effect, that the anti-nuisance rationale would be something that would be quite relevant in these particular cases. And so, therefore, I do think that the ban would be appropriate. Now, this is not to say that there may not be other ways to deal with it. It may well be that you have to engage in some kind of clear cutting before you can start to build in these areas. The problem, as we know, when you start dealing with fires, is the moment you start getting wind and you build yourself a couple hundred yards of separation from the main area in which the fires are at risk, one gust of wind can jump that particular area. There were all sorts of cases in the 19th century involving liability for fire, where you put a stack of flax very close to the track line and it gets burned down, not because of the sparks immediately. The sparks fly over the stacks, it burns some of the land, and then it comes back and picks up the source that's close to the railroad. And so distance is a very imperfect proxy for safety when you're dealing with these tumultuous type situations. And I think on the balance, the traditional notions of the police power would allow these kinds of regulations to be put into place. The subsidy is a no-brainer. The regulations are a little bit more difficult to deal with. But on these particular issues, given the losses that happen to third parties, a modest restriction on the liberty of one group in favor of the enormous protection of another from deadly diseases, I think probably appropriate. And I don't even think that you'd have to compensate under those circumstances.
All right. Thank you, Richard, and thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can read Richard's column. It's called The Libertarian, and it's at Defining Ideas, which you can find at hoover.org. You can also follow him on Twitter. That's at Richard A. Epstein. And if you enjoy the podcast, please rate it on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.